The Valkyrie shuddered around me as we descended through Verdania Prime's atmosphere, the hull plates groaning under the stress of atmospheric entry. Through the narrow porthole beside my restraint harness, I caught glimpses of endless golden fields stretching to the horizon, interrupted by the massive cylindrical shapes of grain silos that dotted the landscape like ancient monuments. The agricultural world looked peaceful from this altitude, almost serene in the morning light filtering through thin clouds. That illusion shattered when the first flak burst exploded 20 meters off our starboard wing. The pilot's voice crackled over the internal vox, tense and clipped, as he reported contact with hostile anti-aircraft positions. Around me, the faces of my squad mates from the 472nd Cadian Shock Regiment tightened with familiar pre-combat anxiety. We had expected light resistance from a few rogue PDF units, not coordinated defensive fire from what appeared to be well-positioned gun emplacements. Another explosion rocked our transport, closer this time, and I felt the deck plates vibrate beneath my boots. Through the vox chatter, I heard fragments of panicked reports from other drop ships in our formation. Three transports had already gone down, their burning wrecks scattered across the agricultural plains below. The anti-aircraft fire was too accurate, too well coordinated for a hastily organized rebellion. The Valkyrie banked sharply to port, throwing us against our restraint harnesses as the pilot attempted evasive maneuvers. I gripped my lasgun tighter, knuckles white against the weapon's polymer stock. The familiar weight provided little comfort as more flak bursts bloomed around us like deadly flowers, their orange flames and black smoke creating a hellish garden in the sky. Our transport shuddered violently as shrapnel peppered the hull. Warning lights bathed the passenger compartment in crimson, and I could smell the acrid stench of burning electronics mixing with the recycled air. The pilot's voice came through the speakers again, this time announcing emergency landing procedures. We were going down whether we liked it or not. The impact came harder than any training simulation had prepared me for. The Valkyrie hit the ground at a steep angle, bounced twice, then skidded through what had once been a wheat field before coming to rest against an irrigation ditch. The sudden silence after the engines cut out felt unnatural, broken only by the groaning of stressed metal and the distant sound of other crashes echoing across the plains. I unbuckled my harness with shaking fingers and checked myself for injuries. A few bruises and a cut on my forehead where I had struck the bulkhead, but nothing serious. Around me, the other members of my squad were pulling themselves together, gathering weapons and equipment from where they had been scattered during the crash. Sergeant Voss was already moving toward the rear exit ramp, his weathered face grim as he surveyed our situation. The ramp lowered with a hydraulic whine, revealing the alien landscape of Verdania Prime. The air that rushed in carried the sweet smell of grain and something else underneath, something organic and wrong that made my nose wrinkle. The golden wheat field stretched away from our crash site, the stalks swaying gently in a breeze that felt too warm for the season. We moved out in standard formation, weapons ready, scanning for immediate threats. The other drop ships from our wave were scattered across kilometers of farmland, some still burning, others silent and dark. Vox attempts to raise command yielded only static and fragments of panicked transmissions from other units. We were on our own until we could reach the primary landing zone and re-establish contact with the regiment. The first indication that something was fundamentally wrong with this world came when we encountered the servitors. They emerged from the wheat field ahead of us, moving with the steady gait of agricultural workers going about their daily tasks. At first glance, they appeared normal enough, humanoid figures in rough work clothing, their movements deliberate and purposeful as they worked their way through the grain. It was only when we got closer that the true horror became apparent. These servitors were harvesting, but not grain. Their mechanical limbs, augmented with cutting implements and collection apparatus, were gathering human remains with the same methodical approach they had once used for crops. Bodies in PDF uniforms lay scattered through the wheat, and the servitors moved from corpse to corpse, their cutting tools separating flesh from bone with practiced efficiency. One of the machines paused in its work as we approached, its head turning toward us with a series of mechanical clicks. Where its eyes should have been, red optical sensors glowed with malevolent intelligence. The face beneath was human once, but now bore the unmistakable marks of extensive augmentation. Cables snaked from ports behind its ears, and its jaw had been replaced with a Vox grill that emitted a low, harmonious hum. The servitor returned to its task without acknowledging our presence, treating us as irrelevant to its current programming. It lifted a severed arm with the same care it might have shown a bundle of wheat, placing it in the collection basket mounted on its back before moving on to the next body. The other machines continued their work around us, creating a grotesque parody of harvest time that made my stomach churn. We gave the servitors a wide berth, but their presence followed us as we moved across the agricultural landscape. Everywhere we looked, the machines were at work, their harvest extending far beyond the immediate crash sites. They had been collecting the dead for some time, judging by the efficiency of their operations and the number of bodies they had already processed. The grain silos dominated the horizon ahead of us, their massive concrete forms rising like cathedral spires from the flat farmland. As we drew closer, details became visible that had been hidden from altitude. The smooth surfaces of the storage cylinders were no longer unmarked. Instead, they bore intricate geometric patterns carved deep into the concrete, designs that seemed to shift and flow when viewed directly. I found myself staring at one of the patterns, trying to make sense of its alien geometry. The lines curved and intersected in ways that hurt to follow, creating angles that seemed to exist in more dimensions than my eyes could process. When I looked away and then back again, the pattern appeared different, as if it had rearranged itself during the moment my attention was elsewhere. The other members of my squad were having similar difficulties with the markings. Trooper Kellick stumbled as he tried to walk while studying one of the silos, his depth perception apparently confused by the visual paradox of the carved symbols. Voss ordered us to avoid looking directly at the structures, but the patterns seemed to draw the eye like magnets, making it almost impossible to ignore them completely. Our Vox equipment had been functioning intermittently since the crash, picking up fragments of transmissions from other scattered units. As we approached the silos, however, the static increased dramatically, filling our headsets with white noise that made communication nearly impossible. Voss attempted to raise regimental commands several times, but received only bursts of interference in response. It was Trooper Danik who first noticed that the static was not random. He had been monitoring the Vox frequencies while we moved, trying to filter out the interference and locate other Imperial forces. What he discovered made him remove his headset with shaking hands, his face pale with a fear I had never seen in a veteran guardsman. The static contained patterns, rhythms that suggested meaning rather than random noise. Buried within the white noise were sounds that resembled words, though spoken in no language I recognized. The syllables were harsh and guttural, with cadences that seemed to bypass the ear and speak directly to some primitive part of the brain. Even without understanding the words, I could sense their malevolent intent, their purpose as invocations to powers that should not be named. Danik tried to explain what he had heard, but the words seemed to stick in his throat. He gestured helplessly at his headset, then at the grain silos ahead of us, as if the connection between the two should be obvious. When Voss ordered him to put the headset back on and continue monitoring, Danik shook his head violently and backed away from the equipment. The effect spread quickly through the squad. Trooper Merrick removed his headset after only a few minutes of listening, claiming that the voices were getting clearer, more insistent. He described hearing his name called through the static, spoken in tones that promised rest and peace if he would only follow the sound to its source. Kellick lasted longer, but eventually succumbed to the same compulsion, dropping his Vox unit and wandering away from our formation toward the nearest grain field. Voss tried to stop him, but Kellick seemed oblivious to orders or threats. He walked into the wheat with the expression of a man following a beautiful melody only he could hear. The golden stalks closed around him, and despite our calls, he did not return. Within minutes, we could no longer see any sign of his passage through the grain. The pattern repeated itself as we continued toward the silos. One by one, members of our squad removed their headsets and drifted away into the fields, drawn by voices that promised answers to questions they had never thought to ask. Voss tried everything he could think of to maintain unit cohesion, but the whispers in the static proved stronger than military discipline. By the time we reached the perimeter of the silo complex, only four of us remained from the original squad. The massive concrete structures loomed over us, their carved surfaces seeming to pulse with malevolent energy. The geometric patterns were more elaborate here, covering every visible surface with designs that made my eyes water when I tried to follow their paths. The servitors were present here as well, but their behavior had changed. Instead of harvesting, they were engaged in construction work, using the human remains they had collected to create new patterns on the ground around the silos. Bones were arranged in precise configurations, flesh was spread in geometric designs, and blood was used to trace connecting lines between different elements of the display. The purpose of this construction was not immediately apparent, but the scale of the operation suggested it had been underway for weeks or months. The servitors worked with the same methodical approach they had shown in the fields, but their movements now carried an undertone of reverence, as if they were participating in a sacred ritual rather than simply following their programming. The abandoned farmstead appeared through the wheat like a mirage, its weathered wooden walls and corrugated metal roof offering the first real shelter we had seen since the crash. Sergeant Voss made the decision to investigate after spotting no movement around the structure for nearly an hour of observation. Our reduced squad of four moved carefully through the grain toward the building, weapons ready despite the apparent emptiness of the place. The farmhouse sat at the center of a cleared area where the wheat had been harvested weeks ago, leaving only stubble and bare earth. Agricultural equipment lay scattered around the property, a rusted thresher, several plows, and irrigation pipes that snaked across the ground like metallic serpents. Everything appeared normal from the outside, the kind of modest homestead that dotted agricultural worlds throughout the Imperium. The front door hung open on corroded hinges, creaking softly in the warm breeze that carried the ever-present smell of grain and that underlying wrongness I still could not identify. Voss entered first, his lasgun sweeping the interior while the rest of us maintained overwatch from outside. His face went rigid almost immediately, and he stepped back from the doorway with an expression I had never seen on the veteran sergeant. When I followed him inside, the scene that greeted me defied immediate comprehension. The farmhouse's main room had been arranged as a dining area, complete with a wooden table, chairs, and place settings for what appeared to be a family of five. The corpses seated around the table were dressed in their finest clothes, positioned as if they had been interrupted mid-meal. Their faces bore expressions of pure terror mixed with something that looked disturbingly like religious ecstasy. The bodies showed no obvious signs of violence or decay despite what must have been weeks of exposure. Their skin maintained a waxy pallor that suggested preservation through unnatural means, and their eyes remained wide open, staring at something beyond the physical world. The youngest victim, a child who could not have been more than 10 years old, sat with tiny hands folded in prayer while his mouth hung open in a silent scream of joy. Each place setting included a plate filled with what appeared to be grain porridge, though the substance had taken on an oily consistency that reflected light in unnatural ways. Flies should have swarmed the food, but the dining room remained eerily free of insects. The silence felt oppressive, broken only by the creaking of the house's wooden frame and the distant sound of wind moving through wheat fields. Trooper Vex, our squad medic, approached the nearest corpse with professional curiosity overriding his obvious revulsion. He examined the body without touching it initially, noting details that escaped my untrained observation. The positioning was too perfect, he explained to Voss, too deliberate to be natural. Someone had arranged these people after death, posing them in their chairs with care that bordered on reverence. The discovery of ritual scarification on the corpse's forearms confirmed Vex's suspicions about deliberate arrangement. The cuts were precise and geometric, forming patterns that echoed the designs we had seen carved into the grain silos. The wounds had been made post-mortem, judging by the lack of blood flow, but they had been filled with some kind of dark substance that made them stand out against the pale skin like brands. We searched the rest of the farmhouse quickly, finding evidence of normal family life in the other rooms. Children's toys lay scattered in one bedroom, while another contained agricultural records and correspondence with grain merchants from across the subsector. The mundane details of rural existence made the horror of the dining room even more jarring, as if the wrongness had invaded a place of simple peace and corrupted it beyond recognition. The sound reached us as we prepared to establish a defensive perimeter around the farmstead. It began as a low rustling in the wheat fields, like wind moving through the stalks, but gradually resolved into something more purposeful. The noise suggested movement through the grain, multiple sources converging on our position from different directions. Voss ordered us to take cover while he attempted to identify the approaching contacts. The first figure emerged from the wheat at the field's eastern edge, and my initial reaction was relief at seeing what appeared to be an Imperial Guardsman. The distinctive outline of flak armor and the measured pace of military movement suggested another survivor from the drop, possibly from one of the other crashed transports. This hope lasted only until the figure drew close enough for me to make out the details of its condition. The guardsman's flak armor had been modified in ways that defied explanation. Agricultural implements had been fused directly into the protective plates, creating a grotesque hybrid of military equipment and farming tools. Scythe blades protruded from the shoulder guards, while thrashing mechanisms had been integrated into the chest piece. The figure moved with jerky, unnatural motions that suggested damage to its nervous system. The most horrifying modification was to the head. Where the guardsman's face should have been, a collection of thrashing blades rotated slowly, their metal edges catching the afternoon light as they moved. The blades were arranged in a circular pattern that mimicked facial features, creating the impression of a mouth filled with spinning teeth. The sound they made was a low, continuous whirring that carried across the empty field like mechanical breathing. More figures appeared from the wheat as we watched in growing horror. Each one had once been an Imperial Guardsman, their uniforms and equipment marking them as members of various regiments. The modifications to their bodies followed similar patterns: agricultural machinery fused with human flesh, faces replaced with farming implements, limbs augmented with cutting tools designed for harvest work. They moved through the grain with purpose, their mechanical components allowing them to process the wheat as they walked. Vex identified them as members of the 23rd Mordian Iron Guard based on the remnants of their uniforms, a regiment that had been deployed to Verdania Prime months earlier to investigate reports of civil unrest. The official records had listed them as missing in action after their transport ships lost contact with Imperial Command. Now we understood what had happened to them, though the knowledge provided no comfort. The transformed guardsmen spread out as they approached the farmstead, their movements coordinated despite the obvious damage to their human components. They showed no recognition of us as fellow Imperial forces, treating our presence with the same mechanical indifference the servitors had displayed. Their purpose appeared to be harvesting, and they began cutting through the remaining wheat stubble around the farmhouse with their integrated implements. One of the creatures passed close enough for me to examine its modifications in detail. The fusion of flesh and machinery was seamless, as if the transformation had occurred at a cellular level rather than through crude surgical attachment. Cables and wiring ran beneath the skin like veins, connecting the agricultural components to what remained of the nervous system. The efficiency of the integration suggested technology far beyond standard Imperial capabilities. The whirring of thrashing blades grew louder as more of the transformed guardsmen converged on our position. They worked methodically through the stubble, their cutting implements reducing the remaining grain stalks to uniform lengths. The sound created a hypnotic rhythm that seemed to resonate with something deep in my skull, making it difficult to focus on tactical considerations. Vex had been treating a civilian we found hiding in the farmhouse's root cellar, an elderly woman who had somehow avoided the fate of her family. She bore bite wounds on her arms and legs that appeared infected, the flesh around the injuries taking on a greenish tinge that suggested serious contamination. The medic worked on her injuries with his usual competence, cleaning and dressing the wounds while administering pain medication from his field kit. The first sign of Vex's transformation came when his surgical instruments began moving independently of his conscious control. The scalpel in his hand traced patterns in the air that matched the geometric designs we had seen throughout the agricultural complex. He stared at the blade in confusion, trying to understand why his motor control was failing, but the movement continued despite his efforts to stop it. His medical knowledge began changing as well, becoming twisted toward purposes that had nothing to do with healing. He started describing surgical procedures that would enhance the human body's capacity for agricultural work, modifications that would allow people to process grain more efficiently. The technical language he used was precise and clinical, but the procedures he outlined were horrifying in their implications. The infected civilian's condition worsened under his care, though Vex seemed oblivious to her deteriorating state. He continued his treatment with growing enthusiasm, describing how the infection was actually an improvement to her biological systems. The greenish discoloration was spreading from her wounds, creating patterns under her skin that resembled root systems or irrigation networks. His surgical tools had developed their own agenda, moving to make incisions that followed no medical logic. The cuts formed geometric patterns that matched those we had seen carved into the silos and scarified onto the corpses in the dining room. Vex watched his hands work with fascination rather than alarm, as if observing someone else perform the procedures he was describing. The revelation about the grain supply came from documents we found in the farmhouse's administrative office. Shipping records showed that Verdania Prime had been exporting agricultural products to dozens of worlds throughout the subsector for years. The volume of trade was enormous, with entire populations dependent on grain shipments from the agricultural world. The corruption we were witnessing had been spreading through the food supply chain for an unknown period. The implications were staggering. If the contamination had been present in the grain exports, then multiple imperial worlds could already be affected. Billions of people across the subsector had been consuming corrupted food, potentially for years. The scope of the infection could extend far beyond Verdania Prime, creating a network of contamination that spanned entire systems. The shipping manifests included destinations I recognized from my service with the 472nd Cadian Shock Regiment. Forge worlds, hive cities, and military installations had all received regular grain shipments from Verdania Prime. The thought of entire regiments consuming corrupted rations made my stomach turn, especially when I considered how many meals I had eaten that might have originated from this cursed world. The transformed guardsmen continued their harvest work around the farmstead as evening approached. Their mechanical components allowed them to work without fatigue, processing grain with an efficiency that surpassed anything human workers could achieve. They paid no attention to our presence, treating us as irrelevant to their agricultural mission unless we directly interfered with their activities. Vex's condition continued deteriorating as the sun set over the wheat fields. His surgical instruments had taken on lives of their own, floating around him in complex patterns while he worked on increasingly bizarre procedures. The civilian woman had stopped responding to his treatment, her body covered in the geometric incisions that seemed to serve some purpose beyond simple mutilation. The medic's knowledge of human anatomy was becoming perverted toward agricultural applications. He described how human bones could be ground into fertilizer, how blood could be used to irrigate crops, and how flesh could be processed into nutrients for soil enhancement. The technical precision of his explanations made them even more disturbing, as if he was describing legitimate medical procedures rather than ritualistic butchery. The moon rose over Verdania Prime as we huddled in the farmhouse, its pale light casting long shadows across the wheat fields. The transformed guardsmen continued their work through the night, their mechanical components eliminating any need for rest. The sound of their thrashing blades created a constant background noise that made sleep impossible, even if we had been inclined to lower our guard. The dawn brought no relief from the mechanical whirring that had plagued us through the night. As I peered through the farmhouse window at the transformed guardsmen still working methodically through the grain stubble, a new horror revealed itself in the morning light. The ground beneath their feet was moving. What I had initially mistaken for shadows cast by the wheat stalks were actually dark patches in the soil itself, patches that shifted and writhed with independent motion. The earth seemed to pulse with a rhythm that matched no natural geological process, creating waves that rippled outward from wherever the corrupted guardsmen walked. The soil was responding to their presence, welcoming them like an old friend. I knelt down and pressed my ear to the farmhouse floor, hoping to understand what was causing the ground disturbance. The wooden boards transmitted vibrations from the earth below, but what I heard defied explanation. The soil was whispering. Countless voices murmured just below the threshold of comprehension, their words blending together into a susurrus of human anguish and longing. Names drifted through the babble, imperial names, Xeno's designations, and syllables that belonged to no language I recognized. The voices grew clearer as I listened, resolving into individual pleas and final thoughts. A Mordian Iron Guard trooper begged for his mother as Law's fire burned through his chest. A PDF officer cursed the Emperor's name as agricultural implements tore him apart. A civilian woman recited prayers to saints I had never heard of while something with too many teeth consumed her alive. The soil had absorbed every death that had occurred upon its surface, preserving the final moments of the deceased in an eternal chorus of despair. Sergeant Voss had discovered similar phenomena in other parts of the farmhouse. The wooden floorboards in the kitchen creaked with voices when stepped upon, while the cellar stairs whispered the names of everyone who had ever descended them. The very foundations of the building had become a repository for human suffering, storing the memories of pain like some grotesque archive. Every surface that touched the earth carried traces of the voices, creating a network of whispered anguish that permeated the entire structure. The revelation about the soil's sentience forced me to reconsider everything we had observed since landing on Verdania Prime. The geometric patterns carved into the grain silos were not decorative elements, but rather conduits for the Earth's accumulated consciousness. The agricultural servitors were not simply following programming, but responding to commands whispered by the ground itself. The transformation of the Imperial Guard Regiment had been guided by an intelligence that existed beneath our feet, one that understood human anatomy and Imperial military doctrine with intimate precision. Trooper Danik had been studying the shipping manifests we found in the farmhouse office, cross-referencing them with his knowledge of Imperial agricultural protocols. His discoveries painted a picture of corruption that extended far beyond the immediate horror of our situation. The contamination had not begun recently, but had been growing for decades, possibly since the first Imperial colonization of Verdania Prime. Every harvest had strengthened the soil's malevolent consciousness, and every shipment of grain had carried that corruption to other worlds. The true architect of this nightmare became clear when Danik uncovered correspondence between the farmstead's owner and the planetary governor's office. The letters dated back 15 years to a period when Verdania Prime had suffered catastrophic crop failures that threatened to starve the entire population. Traditional imperial relief efforts had proven insufficient, and the governor had faced the choice between watching his people die or seeking alternative solutions to the agricultural crisis. The letters described negotiations with entities that were never named directly, but were referred to through euphemisms and coded language. References to the Great Provider and the Harvest Father appeared throughout the correspondence, along with descriptions of rituals that would ensure bountiful crops in exchange for spiritual offerings. The governor had made contact with servants of Nurgle, trading the world's purity for agricultural abundance that would sustain his people through the famine. The pact had worked exactly as promised. Crop yields had increased dramatically following the initial rituals, providing enough grain not only to feed Verdania Prime's population, but to establish the world as a major agricultural exporter. The enhanced fertility had attracted imperial attention and investment, transforming the planet into a vital link in the subsector's food supply chain. The corruption had been subtle at first, manifesting only in slightly unusual growth patterns and minor changes to soil composition. Years of tainted harvests had gradually transformed the planet's ecosystem into something that served Nurgle's purposes. The soil had absorbed the spiritual essence of everyone who died upon it, growing more intelligent and malevolent with each passing season. The agricultural equipment had become infected through contact with the corrupted earth, developing its own malign consciousness that guided it toward purposes that served the plague god's agenda. Even the grain itself had become a vector for contamination, carrying Nurgle's influence to every world that imported food from Verdania Prime. Our attempt to reach the primary Vox relay station began as a tactical withdrawal from the increasingly dangerous farmstead. Vex's condition had deteriorated to the point where he posed a threat to the rest of the squad, his surgical instruments now operating independently while he muttered technical specifications for procedures that violated every principle of Imperial medicine. We left him in the farmhouse cellar with the infected civilian, both of them lost to whatever transformation was overtaking their bodies. The grain fields that lay between our position and the relay station appeared different in daylight than they had during our initial advance. The wheat stalks stood taller than they should have for the growing season, reaching heights that blocked our view of the surrounding landscape. The individual plants seemed healthier and more robust than standard imperial agricultural strains, their golden heads heavy with grain that gleamed with an oily iridescence in the morning sun. We entered the wheat field in standard tactical formation, with Voss taking point while Danik and I maintained interval behind him. The stalks closed around us as we moved deeper into the grain, creating walls of vegetation that limited our visibility to a few meters in any direction. The natural paths between the rows curved and twisted in ways that made navigation difficult, forcing us to rely on compass bearings rather than visual landmarks to maintain our heading toward the relay station. The first indication that something was fundamentally wrong with the grain came when Danik's combat knife sliced through a stalk during our passage. Instead of the clean cut that should have resulted from contact with a sharpened blade, the wheat stalk bled. Dark fluid oozed from the severed stem, carrying the metallic smell of human blood mixed with the sweet scent of grain sap. The liquid moved with purpose rather than simply flowing downward, forming patterns on the ground that resembled the geometric designs we had seen throughout the agricultural complex. Closer examination of the wheat heads revealed horrors that challenged my understanding of biology and agriculture. Instead of normal grain kernels, the stalks bore clusters of human teeth. The dental structures were perfectly formed and varied in size and shape, suggesting they had come from multiple individuals of different ages. Some still retained traces of dental work, metal fillings and crowns that gleamed among the organic material. The teeth were embedded in the wheat heads like seeds, held in place by fibrous material that resembled human gum tissue. The stalks themselves showed signs of anatomical integration that went beyond simple mutation. Vein-like structures ran through the plant stems, pulsing with the same rhythm we had observed in the corrupted soil. The leaves bore patterns that resembled human fingerprints, while the roots that we occasionally glimpsed through breaks in the earth looked disturbingly similar to nervous system tissue. The entire field had become a hybrid organism that combined plant and human characteristics in ways that violated natural law. Our progress through the grain field slowed as we attempted to avoid damaging the stalks unnecessarily. Each cut released more of the blood-like fluid, and the wounded plants seemed to communicate their distress to their neighbors through underground networks. The wheat around damaged areas would bend inward toward the injury, creating natural barriers that forced us to find alternative routes through the field. The vegetation was actively hindering our movement, using its own body to create obstacles that channeled us toward destinations of its choosing. The maze-like quality of the grain field became more pronounced as we continued toward the relay station. Paths that had appeared straight when we entered them curved back on themselves, leading us in circles despite our attempts to maintain consistent compass headings. The wheat stalks grew denser and taller around us, creating corridors that narrowed with each step until we were forced to push through walls of bleeding vegetation. The plants seemed to be growing in real time, responding to our presence by creating increasingly complex barriers. Voss attempted to cut through the grain walls using his chainsword, but the weapon's teeth clogged almost immediately with the fibrous material that connected the human teeth to the wheat heads. The blade's motor strained against the resistance, producing sounds that resembled screaming rather than the normal mechanical whine of a functioning weapon. When he finally managed to clear a passage, the opening sealed itself within minutes as new growth filled the gap with supernatural speed. The discovery of the previous Imperial Guard regiment's fate came when we stumbled into a clearing deep within the grain maze. Scarecrows dotted the open space, their crude construction immediately recognizable as typical agricultural pest control devices. The figures were mounted on wooden posts and dressed in tattered clothing, their arms spread wide in the traditional pose meant to frighten birds away from crops. Only when we drew closer did the true horror of their construction become apparent. The scarecrows had been built using the bodies of Imperial Guardsmen from the 23rd Mordian Iron Guard. Their corpses had been processed in ways that preserved basic anatomical structure while removing everything that might identify them as human beings. The faces had been replaced with carved wooden masks bearing expressions of eternal terror, while the limbs had been repositioned and secured with agricultural wire to create the proper scarecrow pose. Their uniforms had been patched with burlap and straw, transforming military equipment into crude farm clothing. The most disturbing aspect of the scarecrows was that they retained enough consciousness to recognize our presence. Their wooden masks could not move, but their eyes tracked our movement across the clearing with desperate intelligence. Some attempted to communicate through subtle movements of their remaining fingers, tapping out patterns that might have been Morse code or regimental signals. Others simply stared with the hopeless expression of men who had been trapped in their own bodies while their humanity was slowly stripped away. The Scarecrow's equipment told the story of their regiment's final battle. Las guns and flak armor had been distributed among the horrors we had encountered throughout the agricultural complex, repurposed for uses that served the corrupted ecosystem rather than imperial military doctrine. Combat knives had been integrated into the agricultural servitors' cutting mechanisms, while Vox equipment had been modified to broadcast the whispered commands that coordinated the transformed creature's activities. One scarecrow managed to attract my attention through persistent finger movements that spelled out a message in basic Imperial battle cant. The communication was fragmented and difficult to interpret, but the essential meaning was clear. The regiment had been overwhelmed not through superior enemy firepower, but through gradual corruption that had turned their own equipment and supplies against them. Their rations had been contaminated with the tainted grain, slowly transforming them from within while they maintained the illusion of fighting a conventional military campaign. The process had been subtle enough that individual soldiers had not recognized the changes in their comrades until the transformation was too advanced to reverse. Men who had served together for years had become strangers, their personalities altered by the corruption flowing through their bloodstreams. Unit cohesion had collapsed as trust eroded, leaving isolated individuals vulnerable to the agricultural horrors that stalked the grain fields. The final phase had been swift and brutal, with the corrupted soldiers turning on their unaffected comrades in a frenzy of violence that served Nurgle's purposes. The Scarecrow's message included warnings about the relay station that chilled me more than anything we had encountered so far. The facility had been compromised early in the regiment's deployment, its communication equipment modified to broadcast the same corrupted signals we had heard in our Vox units. Any attempt to use the station would result in exposure to concentrated doses of the whispered commands that had driven our squad members into the grain fields. The relay station had become a trap designed to capture and corrupt any Imperial forces that managed to reach it. The warning from the Scarecrow had saved our lives, but it also condemned us to witness the full scope of the horror that had consumed Verdania Prime. With the relay station compromised and our squad reduced to just 3 men, Sergeant Voss made the tactical decision to advance toward the central processing facility that dominated the horizon beyond the grain fields. If we could not call for extraction, perhaps we could at least gather intelligence about the corruption's source before our inevitable deaths. The journey took us through agricultural zones that defied every principle of Imperial farming doctrine. Combine harvesters moved through the grain fields without human operators, their massive forms cutting through wheat with blades that had been modified far beyond their original specifications. The machines bore additional cutting implements welded to their chassis, creating mechanical monstrosities that could process both grain and flesh with equal efficiency. Their collection hoppers overflowed with a mixture of wheat kernels and human remains, the two substances blending together into a paste that would eventually become part of the planet's corrupted food supply. One of the harvesters changed course to intercept our movement across an open field, its engine producing sounds that resembled breathing rather than mechanical operation. The machine's front cutting assembly had been augmented with rotating blades that formed patterns similar to the mouth structures we had seen on the transformed guardsmen. Steam rose from its exhaust ports, carrying the sweet smell of grain mixed with the metallic stench of blood. Warning lights flashed across its control surfaces in sequences that seemed almost like communication attempts. We took cover behind an abandoned irrigation pump as the harvester approached, its massive treads leaving impressions in the soil that filled immediately with dark fluid. The machine paused at the edge of our hiding place, its cutting assembly rotating slowly, as if tasting the air for our scent. Sensors that had once been designed to detect grain density now served different purposes, scanning for human heat signatures and biological markers that would indicate potential harvest targets. The harvester's collection system activated without warning, creating a powerful suction that pulled loose soil and debris toward its intake manifolds. Danik lost his footing as the ground beneath him shifted, sliding toward the machine's cutting assembly before managing to grab hold of the irrigation equipment. His combat knife fell from his belt and disappeared into the harvester's processing chambers, where it was ground into metal fragments that mixed with the organic matter already present in the collection hopper. Voss attempted to disable the machine using his remaining crack grenades, but the explosives had minimal effect on the harvester's corrupted systems. The blast damaged several external components without stopping the machine's operation, and the wounds in its metal hull began sealing themselves with fibrous material that resembled plant tissue. The harvester had developed regenerative capabilities that allowed it to repair damage using biological processes rather than mechanical replacement parts. The machine's pursuit continued as we fled across the agricultural landscape, its treads leaving trails of contaminated soil that sprouted new wheat growth within minutes of being disturbed. The harvester moved with purpose rather than following simple programming, adapting its route to anticipate our movements and cut off potential escape routes. Its sensors had become sophisticated enough to predict human behavior patterns, turning the pursuit into a deadly game where we were perpetually one step away from being processed into agricultural nutrients. Our escape came only when the harvester encountered a group of the transformed guardsmen working in a nearby field. The machine's targeting systems identified the corrupted soldiers as legitimate harvest targets, shifting its attention away from us to begin processing the unfortunate creatures. The sounds that emerged from the harvester's cutting assembly as it consumed the transformed humans defied description, combining mechanical grinding with organic screaming in ways that suggested the victims retained enough consciousness to experience their own destruction. The central processing facility revealed itself gradually as we approached across the final stretch of cultivated land. The complex was enormous, covering several square kilometers with interconnected buildings that served every aspect of grain processing from initial cleaning to final packaging. Massive silos dominated the skyline, their concrete surfaces covered with the same geometric patterns we had encountered throughout our mission. Steam rose from various processing buildings, carrying chemical smells that made my eyes water and my throat burn. The facility's design incorporated architectural elements that had no place in standard imperial construction. Organic curves replaced straight lines in many structures, while surfaces that should have been smooth concrete showed texture patterns that resembled skin or plant matter. The building seemed to breathe, expanding and contracting slightly as if they possessed their own respiratory systems. Pipes and conduits that connected different sections of the complex pulsed with fluid movement that suggested circulation rather than simple material transport. Human screams echoed from within the processing buildings, but the sounds had been integrated into the facility's operational noise in ways that made them seem like normal mechanical functions. The screams provided rhythm and timing for various automated processes, coordinating the movement of conveyor systems and the operation of grinding equipment. Workers throughout the facility had learned to interpret the vocalizations as operational signals, using human agony as a communication system that guided their daily activities. The main entrance to the complex stood open, flanked by guard posts that had been abandoned weeks earlier. PDF equipment lay scattered around the checkpoint, including weapons that had been modified with agricultural implements in the same manner we had observed throughout the corrupted landscape. The guards themselves were nowhere to be seen, though stains on the concrete suggested they had met the same fate as other human defenders who had tried to resist the facility's transformation. Inside the complex, the scale of the corruption became overwhelming. Processing equipment that had once been designed to clean and package grain now served purposes that violated every principle of food safety and human dignity. Conveyor belts carried mixtures of wheat and human remains through sorting mechanisms that separated the materials based on criteria that defied rational explanation. Some human parts were ground into meal that would be mixed with grain products, while others were processed into fertilizer that would be used to enhance future crop yields. The facility's workforce consisted entirely of the transformed agricultural servitors we had encountered throughout our mission, but here their modifications were more extensive and specialized. Some had been equipped with quality control sensors that allowed them to assess the contamination levels in processed materials. Others bore cutting implements designed specifically for human anatomy, enabling them to process corpses with the same efficiency they had once shown for grain separation. Their movements were coordinated by signals transmitted through the facility's public address system, which broadcast the same whispered commands we had heard in our Vox equipment. The source of those commands became apparent when we reached the facility's central control chamber. The planetary governor had not died when the corruption overtook his world. Instead, he had undergone a transformation that merged his consciousness with the processing facility's operational systems. His body had expanded to fill most of the control room, becoming a bloated mass of flesh that interfaced directly with the complex's machinery through organic conduits that had replaced standard electrical connections. The governor's transformation had enhanced his administrative capabilities beyond normal human limitations. He could monitor every aspect of the facility's operation simultaneously, processing information from thousands of sensors and coordinating the activities of countless servitors with perfect efficiency. His consciousness had expanded to encompass the entire agricultural complex, making him aware of every grain of wheat and every human corpse that passed through his domain. The corruption had not destroyed his intelligence, but had focused it entirely on serving Nurgle's purposes through agricultural production. Organic pipes extended from the governor's transformed body throughout the facility, carrying fluids that served as both communication medium and control system for the corrupted infrastructure. The pipes pulsed with regular rhythms that matched the heartbeat of some enormous organism, distributing commands and nutrients to every corner of the complex. The governor's circulatory system had become the facility's nervous system, allowing him to control every automated process through direct biological interface. The shipping schedules displayed on screens throughout the control chamber revealed the true scope of the threat facing the Imperium. Grain shipments from Verdania Prime were scheduled to reach 17 different worlds within the next month, carrying contamination to populations that numbered in the billions. The corruption would spread through food supplies, affecting entire planetary populations before Imperial authorities could identify and respond to the threat. The agricultural network that sustained the subsector had become a vector for Nurgle's influence on a scale that dwarfed anything we had witnessed on the surface. The facility's power systems offered the only means of preventing the scheduled shipments from reaching their destinations. The complex drew energy from a plasma reactor located in the deepest levels of the main processing building, a fusion system powerful enough to provide electricity for the entire agricultural operation. The reactor's safety protocols had been modified along with everything else in the facility, but the core systems remained vulnerable to catastrophic overload if the containment fields could be destabilized. Accessing the reactor required passage through processing chambers where human screams had been integrated into the operational soundtrack. The sounds guided automated systems through complex procedures, with different vocal patterns triggering specific mechanical responses. Workers moved through the chambers in rhythm with the screaming, their activities coordinated by the audio signals that had replaced standard Imperial work procedures. The integration was so complete that silencing the screams would have shut down major portions of the facility's operation. The reactor chamber itself was a cathedral of corrupted technology, with the fusion core suspended in the center of a space that had been modified to serve ritual purposes as well as power generation. The containment field generators bore the same geometric patterns we had encountered throughout the agricultural complex, their surfaces carved with designs that seemed to focus and channel the reactor's energy output. The plasma contained within the magnetic fields showed colors that did not exist in normal fusion reactions, suggesting that the reactor had been modified to tap into power sources beyond standard Imperial science. Overloading the reactor required manual intervention at multiple control stations positioned around the chamber's perimeter. The safety systems had been designed to prevent exactly the kind of catastrophic failure I was attempting to trigger, but the corruption had introduced vulnerabilities that could be exploited by someone with knowledge of Imperial reactor technology. The process would take several minutes to complete, during which time the facility's security systems would undoubtedly respond to the threat with lethal force. Voss and Danik took positions to defend the reactor chamber while I worked on the overload procedures. Their ammunition was limited, and the facility's servitors had already begun responding to our presence with coordinated attacks that utilized their agricultural cutting implements as weapons. The sound of Law's fire echoed through the chamber as they engaged targets that seemed to emerge from every corridor and maintenance access point. The servitors showed no fear of death, pressing their attacks with mechanical determination that gradually overwhelmed our defensive positions. The first control station accepted my commands without resistance, its systems responding to Imperial override codes that had somehow survived the facility's corruption. Warning lights began flashing throughout the chamber as safety protocols attempted to prevent the reactor overload, but the corrupted systems were unable to distinguish between legitimate maintenance procedures and deliberate sabotage. The containment field generators began cycling through power levels that would eventually destabilize the plasma core's magnetic bottle. Danik fell to a servitor's cutting blade while I worked at the second control station, his blood mixing with the organic fluids that flowed through the chamber's modified infrastructure. The servitor that killed him paused to process his body using integrated harvesting equipment, treating his corpse as raw material for the facility's agricultural operations. His death bought me the time needed to complete the second phase of the overload sequence, but the servitors were adapting their tactics to counter our defensive strategy. The third control station required physical access to internal components that had been modified with organic elements. My hands came into contact with tissues that resembled human organs as I manipulated the reactor's control systems, and the sensation of working inside something that was simultaneously machine and living creature made my stomach revolt. The organic components responded to my touch with movements that suggested consciousness, but they could not prevent me from completing the necessary adjustments to the containment field parameters. Voss died defending the final control station, his chainsword clogged with the fibrous material that connected the facility's biological and mechanical systems. The servitors overwhelmed his position through sheer numbers, their cutting implements processing his body even as he continued fighting with his sidearm. His sacrifice allowed me to complete the reactor overload sequence, initiating a cascade failure that would consume the entire facility within minutes. The plasma reactor's death throes began with harmonics that resonated through the facility's organic infrastructure. The governor's transformed body convulsed as feedback from the overloading systems disrupted his biological interface with the complex's machinery. His screams joined the chorus of human voices that had become part of the facility's operational soundtrack, but his vocalizations carried authority that commanded the attention of every servitor in the complex. The corruption's central intelligence was experiencing something that might have been pain or might have been ecstasy, as the reactor's energy output exceeded safe parameters. The containment field collapse triggered secondary explosions throughout the facility as stored materials ignited under the plasma's intense radiation. The organic pipes that carried the governor's commands burst under pressure that exceeded their biological tolerances, spraying contaminated fluids across processing equipment that had been designed to handle grain rather than radioactive plasma. The facility's hybrid systems began failing in cascade patterns that would have been impossible in purely mechanical infrastructure. I activated my Vox recorder as the reactor chamber filled with lethal radiation, knowing that my death was inevitable, but hoping that some record of our discoveries might survive the facility's destruction. The audio log would document the corruption's scope, and provide intelligence that might help Imperial forces respond to similar threats on other agricultural worlds. The subsector's food supply network remained compromised despite our actions, but at least the immediate shipments from Verdania Prime would never reach their destinations. The facility's final moments were marked by a sound that combined mechanical failure with organic death, as if some enormous creature was breathing its last breath through damaged lungs. The governor's consciousness fragmented as his biological connections to the complex were severed by the spreading destruction. His individual identity reasserted itself briefly before being consumed by the plasma fire that spread through the organic conduits he had become. The intelligence that had coordinated the facility's operations dissolved into component parts that could no longer function as a unified whole. The plasma reactor's explosion vaporized the central processing facility and created a radioactive crater that would remain uninhabitable for centuries. The blast's electromagnetic pulse disabled electronic systems across hundreds of square kilometers, silencing the whispered commands that had coordinated the agricultural corruption throughout the region. The immediate threat to the subsector's food supply had been eliminated, but the contamination that had already spread to other worlds remained beyond our ability to address. 3 weeks after the facility's destruction, an inquisitorial investigation team recovered my audio log from the radioactive ruins. The recorder had survived the explosion by chance, protected by debris that shielded it from the worst of the plasma fire. My final transmission provided intelligence that led to quarantine procedures for 17 worlds that had received grain shipments from Verdania Prime, though the effectiveness of those measures remained uncertain given the corruption's subtle nature. The Inquisition's subsequent investigation revealed that similar agricultural worlds throughout the sector showed signs of comparable corruption, suggesting that Verdania Prime had been part of a larger network serving Nurgle's purposes. The contamination had spread through trade relationships and administrative connections that spanned multiple subsectors, creating a web of influence that would require decades to map completely. The true scope of the threat remained unknown, hidden within the Imperium's vast agricultural infrastructure where corruption could spread undetected for generations. The Emperor protects, but sometimes protection comes too late to prevent the seeds of damnation from taking root in human soil.